come to the Home Depot this month and you'll learn a thing or two. Actually, three, with three free do-it-yourself workshops. Learn how to design and care for your container garden by selecting the best soil and aesthetically arranging your plants. Learn how to install tile flooring, even how to keep your outdoor deck and patio space in the best shape possible. See, it's never too late to learn something new. Register today at homedepot.com/workshops for a do-it-yourself workshop near you. Only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family. Today, we're going to be talking about why Black, Hispanic, and Asian women are less likely to get pregnant with infertility treatment. Some results of some fascinating research, some of which was reported at ASRM, but also some much longer research that's been done not only from the medical standpoint, but also the cultural and social and a lot of other things. Really important topic. I'm really sure you're going to enjoy it. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
They looked at over 225,000 cycles, and they found that the pregnancy rates were lower. The clinical intrauterine gestational rates were lower among Asian, Hispanic, and Black women, statistically significantly different. And then when they kind of plotted that out and looked at outcomes and pregnancy losses and live birth, they found that the likelihood of live birth was also statistically different among the races.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport, and I'm the host as well as the director of Creating a Family. You can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring has a free program they want you to know about, My Fertility Navigator. This program offers free one-on-one support for women who are struggling to get pregnant and are quite not sure what their next step ought to be. And the beauty of this program is that once enrolled, you will receive a personalized guidance from a real human being who they call a fertility navigator. And this person can provide you with information, basic information about fertility, as well as helping you connect with a nearby fertility center and providing you information on financial resources and things such as that. You can get more information by going to their website, myfertilitynav.com, myfertilitynav.com. Today we're going to be talking about a subject I am personally very interested in, why women of color are less likely to get pregnant with infertility treatment. Our guest today is Dr. Tori Kamau-Plowden. She is a reproductive endocrinologist and a researcher in the area of disparity with success rates for minorities as well as access to care. Welcome, Dr. Plowden, to Creating a Family. We are so glad to have you here.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
You know, this is the timing for this show, we couldn't have done it better. Michelle Obama just came out, just last week with her book, Becoming. And although I haven't read the book, I have read and listened to as many of the interviews, and I will be reading the book. One of the things that, to say it was a bombshell might be a slight overstatement, but it was still a surprise. And especially both my social media feed as well as my emails exploded when she announced that both of her children were conceived through IVF when she and Barack were in their 30s. And I was both fascinated by that, and I was so happy that she didn't have to, her kids are older. There was no reason for her to even have to share it. And it's certainly none of our business, but I was thankful because it seems to me that by her opening up, it brings into the topic of conversation with all races, but especially for Black women, the idea of infertility. And it certainly seems to me that one of the greatest myths is that infertility is a white woman's issue, specifically a white woman of certain age and certain means, and that IVF is a white woman's solution. Dr. Plowden, is that a myth that you see in your practice as well?
I have definitely encountered that. I think, There seems to be a lot of this, and this can be true among all women of various races, but there seems to be a lot of shame surrounding a diagnosis of infertility. Mm-hmm. Women will often, feel alone, like, they're the only person who is going through this. Often it's happening in conjunction with many of their friends conceiving seemingly effortlessly.
Yes,
exactly. And so it can be a very lonely time for people. And, in a lot of cultures, talking about difficulties getting pregnant is not something that people often do. So they don't even feel comfortable talking about it among with their parents or their peer groups. And so, if you don't know that this is something that's common, then you might think that it's just you. And there can be a lot of shame around that, and it seems just very taboo for some people.
Yeah, I think so. Quite a number of years ago, we did a show on infertility in the African American community. And we spoke a lot about that, the cultural taboos, both with talking about infertility, the religious taboos with talking about sex in general, and all of that combined makes it, I think, potentially harder. I think for all races, you're exactly right. I think everyone struggles with this, and I think that's very typical. But and perhaps it's worse in the African American community. Let's talk about the Hispanic community. Is it harder to talk about infertility from what you can see or any research you've done or read from the Hispanic? And let's go ahead and throw in Hispanic and Asian. Do they suffer some of the same cultural issues that would make it harder to discuss infertility?
Yeah, it does seem so. I think for some Hispanic and Asian women, particularly if English is not their first language, there can be the added factor of like language issues, language barriers, not knowing who to come to for help, or not being able to actually access even their primary care physicians or a general OBGYN to find like where the right place to go is. But there does seem to be some also cultural taboos that are different. For instance, I had a patient recently whose spouse is from Laos, L-A-O-S, originally, uh-huh. And they were trying to find a sperm donor with the same background. And she was looking at many different sperm banks across the country, and she was not coming, she had not yet been able to find such a donor. The patient was a Caucasian woman, and it was very important for them to have a child that represented the mm-hmm. mixed ancestry that had they conceived spontaneously that child would have had. I mean, they were having a difficult time. She said that it seemed like from her spouse's culture that, donating to a sperm bank for that group of people was something that was like less likely to be done and something that might be frowned upon. So she had very real concerns that she might not be able to find a suitable sperm donor, or that they may have to potentially use sperm from a person of a similar genetic background, mm-hmm. Another mm-hmm. type of Asian person, as opposed to the one that matches her spouse most closely.
I've heard that, and the other thing is that I don't know this to be a fact, but I suspect that there would be less advertising from the donor sperm, the cryobank community, into Laotian communities, Vietnamese communities, or any community of color, and perhaps Hispanic as well. So that would also play into why there might be fewer sperm donors. And I've certainly heard for women who are seeking both sperm as well as egg donation, it is harder to find a Asian I'm not sure about black, as far as perhaps black even as well with egg donation. Do you know if egg donation? Do you know if the if there are fewer representative as to the proportion of the population black eggs in egg banks are women who have black women who have signed up to be egg donors? Or I haven't seen that. I'm kind of guessing.
I haven't seen good data on it. I have heard anecdotally from.
Same here.
From colleagues who have donor banks in their area, that they've noticed that, but I haven't seen any actual research done on it.
Same here. No, nor have
and
I.
And egg banking is relatively egg banking is still relatively new.
Yeah.
So I don't know if
exactly.
the answer is well known.
Well, we could look at seeing what egg donor agencies, which are doing live donations. Although then often if you're looking for a particular ethnicity, they go out and advertise specifically for that person. So it might be a little different. Egg banking might be a better, All right, so let's talk about some of the, we've talked about there being some myths. Let's talk about some of the reality. Is there any difference, do you see a difference in the research for rates of infertility let's speak for just women right now, let's use Caucasian women as a base. Are there any differences when you look at the African American community in the rate of infertility, higher, lower, or about the same?
It seems like the prevalence overall may be similar, but the causes of infertility vary substantially by race. African American women are much more prone to have what we call uterine factor infertility, which is related to fibroids. They also tend to have tubal factor infertility, so a higher likelihood of having tubal blockages that could be a contributor to their infertility. And then it also seems like there's a higher likelihood among African American women in general of obesity, and obesity can play a negative role in reproduction in a variety of ways. But definitely the likelihood of those diagnoses are different among Caucasians versus African American women.
Why are we've done a number of shows on fibroids. Do we know why African American women, and they are substantially more likely to have fibroids than I think any other race. Do we know why? Is it a genetic cause? Are environmental? Do we have any idea why?
It is still unclear. There's ongoing research to try to iron out some of that. We do know that in African American women, they tend to present with fibroids at an earlier age, and that when they present with fibroids, they tend to be much more profound. They have a higher fibroid burden. You know, these are women who can often even in their 20s have multiple fibroids. These are women who sometimes have to have multiple fibroid surgeries to remove the fibroids to improve their likelihood of pregnancy. So the actual reason for that is still unclear, but it definitely is much more prevalent among African American women.
And what about tubal factors? Why would black women, and we're going to move to other races here in just a minute, but why are black women more likely to have tubal blockage? And that we're talking fallopian tubes, just for everybody. You know, the egg is released from the ovary and then has to be picked up and travel through the fallopian tube, where in an ideal world, a sperm meets and fertilizes within the fallopian tube, and the egg goes down through the fallopian tube and is deposited into the uterus, where, again, we hope that this implants and grows for 9 months. Anyway, that's a basic biology 101, cliff note version. And as a reproductive endocrinologist, we're probably just cringing at my oversimplification. But nonetheless,
that's pretty good.
It's pretty basic. So we've talked about the fibroids, which would impact implantation. But you also mentioned tubal issues, which moving up the chain, implant fertilization, because the sperm can't meet the egg in the fallopian tube. So why would black women be more likely than other races to have tubal blockage?
So tubal blockage can often result from exposure to chlamydia or gonorrhea, so sexually transmitted diseases. Sometimes women in minority communities, either African American or Hispanic women, are more likely to have those. Let me say that in a different way. If they have exposure to gonorrhea and chlamydia, they may be less likely to receive the appropriate treatment, which could put them at a higher risk of developing tubal disease. So sometimes these ladies don't always have access to care to get treated appropriately. So sometimes they may not have been diagnosed until, you know, much later, until they've developed like a severe pelvic inflammatory disease. And so that can be a reason why they are more likely to suffer tubal damage.
Okay, so now we've talked about the rates being, you said basically the rates of infertility may be about the same, but the causes might be different. Now that's for African American women. So let's talk about for Hispanic and Asian, what's known as far as their rates of infertility compared again, say, to whites.
So, again, I think it's similar, although it is a little bit of a confounder because women from these cultural backgrounds tend to present for care less often. We may be incorrect about this, meaning that if the women who are in these other communities and they are infertile but they're not coming in for treatment, then we can't really accurately predict the prevalence because we really don't know how many people are truly affected. We're only able to comment on people who have actually come in for evaluation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. No, I hear exactly. So it appears that it's about the same, but you're putting a caveat out there saying, but, you know, it's possible that if we were able, which we're really not, but if we were able to do a study that studied women, all women, not just women who are coming into care, we might possibly see something. Do we know if the causes for Hispanics or Asian women, the causes of infertility, are any different than, say, from white women or even African American women?
For Hispanic women, they are also seem to be at a higher likelihood of having tubal factor too.
But not necessarily fibroids.
Not necessarily fibroids.
Okay, interesting.
Not necessarily fibroids. There was one large database study that was done back in, I think, 2016 by Humphreys et al., and they saw in their particular study, African-American women were 6 times more likely, and Hispanic women were 2 times more likely to have had a prior diagnosis of chlamydia. They also found that uterine factor was much higher among black women in their patient population.
And there's also a, we'll talk about this later, as to why people of color, women of color anyway, enter treatment later. There's also been some interesting research which has tried to see, understand what the knowledge of people in various communities are about certain fertility issues. And the knowledge that an STD, sexually transmitted disease, can impact, after treatment, can impact fertility, was something that was very low, as well as interesting, this one really surprised me, that knowledge that how dramatic age impacts fertility was also fairly low in communities of color. That one surprised me. It didn't surprise me about the lack of knowledge about STDs, because I actually think that's pretty much across the board. I'm going to read out some stats just that I found that I thought were interesting. Married black women between the ages of 25 and 44 are nearly twice as likely to have infertility problems than married white women. And that was from the CDC. I thought that was interesting. Let's see. But they are more likely to get treatment, 8% of black women and 8% of Latinas between, the ages of 25 and 44 have used fertility treatment, and that's compared to about 15% for white women of a similar age. And I don't believe there was any information on Asian women in this particular study. So I'm just looking through to see if I see any other interesting things. All right, so we've talked about women. One of the things that I think we so often overlook in the whole infertility world, and that is talking about male factor, either as the primary contributing cause to a couple's infertility or as a commingled cause. So I'm going to admit up front that I was reading a lot of the studies that were presented at ASRM this year, and I may have just missed it. And I don't really know of studies on this, so I'm hoping you do. And that are black men more likely to have infertility or less likely? Is there any evidence about the sterility up or down compared to other races for black men?
I am not aware of any study that has specifically addressed that. Yeah, I'm not aware of any study that looks specifically at that.
I'm not either, and I did do a little looking, not a lot. So if anybody in our audience knows of any, if you will shoot me an email at info@creatingafamily.org, I would really appreciate it because I'm curious about that as well. And I would think that would be the very same for Hispanic and Asian men. I'm guessing you probably don't know that either.
Mm-mm. I haven't seen any study looking by race at male infertility. I think you make a good point, though, that sometimes the milk factor is overlooked. And that's part of why, when we work up a woman for infertility, it's a couple. We work up the husband at the same time as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think lots of people tend to assume that it must be something going on with the wife. But the truth is that it's almost like a rule of thirds, where a third of the time it's a female factor, something with the tubes or the ovaries, or there's a third of the time there's male factor, and then another about third of the time there can be several different things that are going on, that the there may be a male component and a female component to mm-hmm. the infertility. It's recommended that we work up both couples at the couple at the same time, as opposed to saying, oh, something's going on with this lady, we need to do this first. We need to really evaluate the sperm parameters and see what's going on there before we can make a good plan about how to proceed with this particular couple. Because, for instance, if a woman is ovulatory and her uterus looks normal and her tubes are open, but we don't know if the sperm are working well or if the sperm counts are normal or the motility is normal, then treating her, is not really, it totally changes our treatment plan based on what his sperm look like.
Absolutely. And I think clearly when people get to an infertility clinic, to a reproductive endocrinologist, I mean, that's going to happen. But I'm still surprised at the number. And let's face it, most people do begin with their gynecologist, and I am surprised at the number of gynecologists who are starting to perform tests on the women before they even do a sperm analysis. I don't think that happens once you get to a clinic, an infertility clinic, but it's still pretty common before that process, before you in the, or at least it is from people we talk to.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now I want to shift to something that. I think at least I have been aware of the different causes of infertility, as well as the lack necessarily of getting into treatment of women of color, and I should say couples of color. But I think what is interesting, and there seem to be a fair number of studies that were reported this year, although it's not necessarily new, is that infertility treatment is not as successful in women of color. So if you could break down the success rates, and you presented on this at ASRM this year, the success rates for white, black, Hispanic, and Asian women. And then go ahead, and while you're doing it, let's talk about the live birth rate. So let's talk about pregnancy rates and live birth rates for these races by comparison.
Okay.
Do you have that?
I have a chart that was pulled from a particular database study I was trying to find.
Here,
okay.
I'll pull it up.
So
too.
This, go ahead. This was a study that was done. This actually is a little bit of an older study. It was done in 2010 by Baker et al. And it was published in Fertility and Sterility, which is one of our main infertility journals. And they use the SART database, which is the SART database basically is it reports data from most of the clinics within the United States. I think it's something like maybe 95% of the data from clinics in the U.S. are reported to SART, and it looked at it looked at pregnancy rates and also live birth rates. And basically, they used the Caucasian patient as like the reference category, and compared Asian, Hispanic, and Black women to white women. And they looked at over 225,000 cycles, And they found that the pregnancy rates were lower. The clinical intrauterine gestational rates were lower among Asian, Hispanic, and Black women, statistically significantly different. And then when they kind of plotted that out and looked at outcomes and pregnancy losses and live birth, they found that the likelihood of live birth was also statistically different among the races. So the Asian women had the highest likelihood, of course, after the white ladies, theirs was still lower. And then the Hispanic ladies were even lower, and then the African-American women were even lower than that as far as live birth.
And the African-American women, this surprised me. I know the study you're talking about, Baker et al., Fertility and Sterility, 2010. But the African-American women, if we take the white women as the reference point, so that they're a 1.0, they're a 1. And Asians were 0.89, so slightly below. I think they did say it was statistically significant. And Hispanics were right below that, 0.87. But Black women were 0.62. I'm not sure you could say that they're almost half as likely, because I'm not. I took stats in college and in graduate school, but I don't really. I know that may not exactly work to say almost half, but 0.62 compared to women. This is talking about pregnancy, live birth. I believe this was live birth, and that's significantly different. I mean, that's kind of surprising.
It is. And I think, so one thing to point out with these with this database study, so something is obviously there. This is fairly convincing data. One drawback of this kind of study with the database is that race is not, at that time, race was not a required reporting in that database. And so there are a lot of cycles that we could not use to study this because the race of the patient was not reported. So, you know, maybe it's possible that could affect numbers, but even among the ones that we were able to report the race, it was a large difference. There are substantial disparities in reproductive health for African-American women throughout reproductive health, not just specifically related to infertility or the ability to become pregnant with IVF, but preterm labor and delivery is much, much higher among African-American women for reasons that are not 100% clear. Of course, there can certainly be issues with access to care, and there can certainly be issues with, socioeconomic status. But even when controlling for socioeconomic status, Black women are still at a higher likelihood to deliver preterm.
Could that be related to fibroids? Because fibroids, that's one of the risk factors of fibroids. So have they ever controlled for the fibroid to see if that is that the contributory cause?
There is a study that controlled for fibroids. I don't have that one in front of me right now, and I don't remember all of the details. But even when you control for those sorts of factors, access to care, socioeconomic status, prevalence of fibroids, it still seems that Black women have a higher likelihood of preterm delivery. There are some studies out there just looking at, the effect of racism, the effect of stress. It's kind of very difficult to look at those sorts of factors because they're multifactorial, and it's kind of it's not like it's in a vacuum, and it's kind of hard to kind of tease some of that out. But even when the Black woman has access to care and has access to money and all of those sorts of things, nutrition, all of that sorts of thing, they are employed and have a higher socioeconomic status, they still tend to do worse than women who are of a similar socioeconomic status but who are white.
That's some of the research that I was reading, and I find that so discouraging and interesting, but also discouraging. So we've talked about that, but let's go back to now. You're talking about live birth rates. So it seems like we have a couple of compounding factors. One, IVF is less successful in women of color. And then two, pregnancy is less, they're more likely to deliver early. And obviously that has a significant negative impact on the live birth rate, of, depending on the degree of prematurity. But let's go back to the beginning part, because I want to circle back to talking about racism and some of the other things. But let's go back to treatment itself not being successful, IVF, and specifically what we're talking about here. Although that's an interesting, I didn't even think about that. Has there been research on whether oral meds, letrozole or Clomid, the effectiveness of that? Do you see any difference on the effectiveness of oral fertility meds on women of color?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I can't think of any studies offhand that look at that.
Yeah, that's curious to me.
It's sometimes harder
talking about IVF. Yeah,
because like in the database studies, these are women who have undergone IVF. It doesn't always include women who have had infertility treatments that are less aggressive.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know that. I don't know. I'm not sure of a good place to look for that sort of data.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but I wasn't also looking for it. Well, cause, so we're just so everybody knows, we're primarily talking about IVF is what we're talking about. All right, so we know that the success rates of IVF itself are less. So do we know what are some of the factors that cause infertility treatment to be less successful in Black women and Hispanic women and Asian women? You mentioned access to care. Let's start there. What do you mean by access to care?
IVF is very costly treatment, and there are some states do have like insurance mandates, but the majority of the states do not. So sometimes women of color may be less likely to present for care. That could and one contributor could be the cost. There are certainly steps that can be used to treat a person and potentially give them a pregnancy or a live birth prior that are less costly than IVF. Like people think of infertility and they think immediately of IVF, but there are often other ways that a person can become pregnant that are less aggressive, depending on, of course, the diagnosis, the reason for the infertility. But there's also been some data out there to show that even among people who are kind of like those gatekeepers. So and what I mean by that is I mean like perhaps the primary care doctor or even a general OBGYN, that they might be less likely to refer patients who are of women of color just because they themselves might think that the person can't afford it without even necessarily asking. A colleague of mine, she works in Oklahoma, and she was on the panel for this ASRM discussion that we did at this past ASRM. And many people in her patient population are Native American, and they weren't seeing referrals to their clinic of many Native Americans. And when speaking to some of the providers who were seeing these people, some of it was that those Native American patients might not necessarily have been interested in treatment, perhaps, but a lot of doctors were assuming that they weren't interested or assuming that culturally they would not want something that aggressive, and they weren't referring the patients. She actually established a partnership with the tribe, and I apologize, I don't remember specifically which tribe it is, but with the tribal leaders. And then she did some community outreach where they went to that group and did some outreach and kind of did some education and basically explained to them that, you know, IVF might not be necessary for everyone. Mm-hmm. And then once they answered those questions for that group, they noticed an increase in people who were referred to them and sought treatment. And some people did become pregnant, certainly without having to move to infertility, to IVF, which is the most aggressive of the treatments. But the point was, is that, you know, even providers have biases there can be implicit bias, and it's not the onus is not on the doctor to, you know, decide, oh, these people wouldn't want that treatment, so I'm not going to refer them. Like, that's a little crazy when you think about it.
Yeah.
But in that particular patient population, access to care wasn't even necessarily coming from the patient themselves. It was coming from some biases from the physicians who typically would have been in that referral population. There's also been some data that kind of I'm trying to pull it up here. Sorry.
Are you going to move into talking about later entry into care, or are you still going to talk about access
later
to care?
Access to care. Just that basically was talking about, it was a survey looking at primary care doctors and how, you know, and how they weren't necessarily referring patients of all races. There was one particular study that I found, like, I found it so crazy. I don't have the study in front of me, but the information was that white women with cancer were two times more likely to be referred for fertility preservation than women of other races. And that was specifically among women who had cancer. So even in the face of cancer, some physicians were less likely to refer women of other races to even discuss fertility preservation. And that's, I mean, that's wrong. And it's kind of scary.
And we're talking, so that everybody knows, we're not talking about fertility doctor here. We're talking about, and I like the term you used, Dr. Plowden, you were saying gatekeepers. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about primarily primary care doctors, GPs, internists, and gynecologists. And so that's they're the people who we go to who normally are the ones who tell us when we need to go see a specialist. And you have to wonder if there's some buy-in to some of the stereotypes of hyperfertility among. I mean, you wouldn't think that educated people would fall for that, but there is a I believe anyway, a cultural myth that women of color, let's say specifically black women and Hispanic women, are, you know, that they have lots of babies. You know, that's what they do. They're baby making machines. And so I wonder if that's the I don't think that the study I didn't read the whole thing. I read the excerpt. I mean the summary of that research you were just referring to, and I don't think they went into the reasons why. But I did. I found that really kind of it was both interesting and very depressing.
There is a cultural myth. You know, when people talk about, you know, African American women or Hispanic women, you know, they're super fertile. They have, you know, 5, 6, 7 babies, and they're taxing the system. You do hear that, and I think that is it's obviously a misconception and a gross misrepresentation of what's accurate and correct. But I think also even some women may internalize that kind of a stereotype, and that can be why infertility can be so isolating. If you're an African American woman and you've kind of thought your whole life that, you know, oh, we get pregnant so easily, and then you can't, then you think that, oh my God, this is something's just very wrong with me, and it can be you know, a source of shame, a source of guilt.
Absolutely.
And it's also just inaccurate. But there certainly are those stereotypes within in America, and it can make physicians perhaps more less likely to refer patients appropriately, which is disturbing, to say the least. Now, there have been some other there was a study that was done at Walter Reed, which is an Army medical facility. And this study was done by, I think it was Sakme et al. And it's a little bit of an older study. But the system in the military is a little bit different in that cost is not as much of a factor. Meaning that their access to care it tends to be a little bit better. And so in that system, they found that African American women were more likely to seek out infertility treatment But Hispanic women were still less likely to seek out infertility treatment in that kind of like equal access to care setting. And it was unclear why that was. Perhaps that might be a little bit of a cultural barrier among Hispanic women, or it could have also been a language barrier. Maybe that was a concern. But there was some research that showed that, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, let me pause for a moment to remind everyone that you're listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking about differences in pregnancy rates and fertility treatment success for Black women, Hispanic women, and Asian women. This show, as well as all the resources we provide at Creating a Family, could not and would not happen without the generous support of our partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. One such partner is Shreff 2.0. They are a specialty fertility pharmacy that believes pharmacy care can and should be remarkable, and they really mean that. I met with them at ASRM, and I was so impressed with their entire team. All of their employees, and they mean all, even you know, obviously the pharmacists, but even down to the shipping coordinators, understand infertility and infertility treatment and the stress of that. And they do such a good job of educating and supporting the patient community. We also have Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of prospective sperm donors to provide the client with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. And in addition to donor sperm services, they also offer a full range of andrology and fertility preservation services. Coming back to, we're talking with Dr. Tori Cabot-Plowden. She's a reproductive endocrinologist, and this is her specialty, or she's certainly done research in the area of healthcare disparities in the area of reproductive health. One of the interesting things, we're talking now about fertility treatment being less successful than women of color. And we preach all the time here at Creating a Family that age is the number one factor that we have to be aware of and we've as far as success of treatment, and we need to get women into treatment sooner. And what some of the research shows is that women of color are likely to enter care later than and again we're comparing things to the to white women, so later than white women. And there were a number of women. One, the thing you just mentioned, if you believe that you're the race that you come from or the ethnicity that you are from is hyper-fertile, then it's more likely, if you think about it, to say, okay, well, you know, I may not have gotten pregnant in the first 8 months, but I'll give it a couple, you know, I'll give it another 8 months because, you know, everybody, you know, all my friends and family get pregnant. So that, I mean, that could play into waiting to get into care, it seems to me. I'm not sure if that's actually been teased out by the research, but it makes common sense to me that myth could make it harder for people, women, to say, okay, I got to get into care. Dr. Plowden, is that something that you've seen as well?
I don't know if it's been for that reason or not, but often when patients will come in and you know, and you get their history, it seems, this is a little anecdotal, but it seems to me like some of the African-American patients or the Hispanic patients are more likely to say, oh, we've been trying for 5 years, or we've been trying for, you know, X amount of time, and then we just decided to finally get evaluated. Typically, when we are talking about the definition of infertility, we're talking about trying for 12 months or more, unprotected intercourse without success. Now, that's specifically in women who are less than 35. Mm-hmm. If the woman is 35 or older, we typically will start an evaluation after 6 months. And that's partly because, you know, time is not on our side. You know, aging is an issue. But also because in that age group, there is, like, more likely to be some sort of reason why they may not be getting pregnant. Mm-hmm. So we like to use 12 months if they are younger than 35 and about 6 months if they are 35 and older.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that I mentioned earlier about entry into care is not understanding the impact of sexually transmitted diseases on fertility. Mm-hmm. And as I said, there was a a study that asked questions and that broke it down by race or ethnicity, and they specifically were asking, you know, is this statement true or false, and talking about the impact of STDs. Communities of color were less knowledgeable about that. So if you had had an STD when you were much younger and you were aware that, oh, wait, this could impact my fertility, then that might propel you after you've been trying for a year when you're 30, if you're not pregnant, to quickly get into treatment as opposed to saying, well, let's give it another 6 months. So I think that absolutely has to impact. Fertility awareness in general, I should say, impact of age and weight also played in on that. I'm sorry, I interrupted. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, fertility awareness, I think, among many women, just isn't, sadly, is not where you would think that it would be. There was a study published in Fertility and Sterility relatively recently. I think it was in 2016. And they looked at knowledge, attitudes, and practices regarding conception and fertility. And they found that, and this was across all races, they found that about 40% of women believe that ovaries continue to produce new eggs. So women are, you know, you're born with the number of eggs that you're going to have, and you basically, that declines as we age until menopause. 25% of these women were unaware that obesity or menstrual irregularity could impact fertility. 20% of the women in that study were unaware that the effect of age on infertility. And I think it's important to mention that the majority of the women in this particular study, more than half, were college educated.
I know.
And yet they
still feel like we're failing.
Yeah, I agree.
yeah.
It was very eye-opening, I thought, just to kind of look at this information. There have been some other studies looking at fertility awareness, and it seems that, in general, that there are more there are more misconceptions among women of color than among Caucasian women. But in general, a large percentage of women are unaware of these things. And then, you know, you have other factors out there in the media. So, for instance, there are many celebrity women who become pregnant at much older ages, even in their 50s, and who many of them have twins. You know, none of them seem to have children that are affected by congenital abnormalities or chromosomal abnormalities such as Down syndrome. And the truth of the matter, you know, statistically, most of these ladies are probably using donor egg or some form of assisted reproductive technology to achieve these pregnancies. And for these celebrity women, you know, money is not really a factor because they have, you know, many of these women are actresses and millionaires and that sort of thing. And I think that translates to women feeling like they have you know, all the time in the world, you know, if so-and-so got pregnant at 48 with twins, I'm only 35, so I have plenty of time. And that's not really an accurate representation. It's interesting that you mentioned our former First Lady Michelle Obama. I actually saw her speak just the other day, and
she talked
a little bit. I'm sorry, say again?
Lucky dog. I said,
I know, it was incredible. Oh, that's a whole other story. But she spoke. She did mention the reason that she said that she mentioned her struggle with infertility was one, to make people more aware. But she said also age is a factor. And as women, you know, women who, you know, have these careers and are successful, one thing that you really must consider if you aspire to have children is where that will fit in. Mm-hmm. During that time period. And she said she, you know, she brings that up often with, you know, people that she's close to and also other people that she might mentor or other professional women that she knows, because many women, you know, this is not like necessarily at the forefront of their minds. I think that we spend a lot of time as younger ladies, you know, trying to avoid pregnancy and using contraception appropriately so that we can become pregnant when we're ready. And yet you don't anticipate that when you are ready that it will not just happen quite easily. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, aging is a factor. There really is a biological clock, and it really, you know, does have a limit.
Yeah, and we need more women to speak up. Mm-hmm. And it's none of our business how celebrities conceive, and I appreciate their desire for privacy.
Sure.
But I also am very appreciative when they are open, and I particularly resent, quite frankly, when they imply that they did not, when chances are extraordinarily good that they did. It's one thing to just be mute on it, and there's a whole other thing to actively imply that. I heard one woman one time talking about it as an accidental pregnancy, and I'm thinking it's possible. I mean, it is possible. But, yeah, probably not. But, again, it's none of our business, I suppose. Let's go back to talking about some of the reasons that the causes are some of the reasons why infertility treatment is less successful in women of color. One that you've mentioned is black women and Hispanic women, and I don't believe this holds true for Asian women, have a higher incident of obesity than do white women generally in the population. Is mm-hmm. that true? I think I've seen studies on that. Dr. Plown, have you seen any? Yeah. So
yes,
and obesity
is
a big deal for
obesity
fertility.
Obesity is a big deal. Mm-hmm.
As well, fertility as well as carrying a baby to term. So both obesity
right.
can impact both.
It can, yes. Mm-hmm. And there have been, you know, ladies who are obese are more likely to have often issues with ovulation, and so sometimes it may be difficult for them to become pregnant spontaneously. But then they also have a higher likelihood of perhaps having chronic disease. So these ladies are often can be more likely to have issues with chronic hypertension and issues with diabetes even before pregnancy, or they might be more likely to develop those issues in pregnancy, which can lead to, you know, substantial complications and substantial morbidity for both the mother as well as the child.
Mm-hmm.
There's been even some studies that have kind of shown that women with significant obesity, that their babies have a higher likelihood of perinatal death, so death within the early part of life for unclear reasons. There's a lot of issue with obesity. It's kind of hard specifically for women who already have infertility when obesity is an issue and then perhaps they're older already, and so now time is an issue too, and we're trying to figure out, you know, the
mm-hmm.
best ways to treat them and to try to help them get pregnant while also trying to, you know, mitigate some of the risk associated with it, and it can be very, very challenging. But
mm-hmm.
certainly in America, obesity has become quite prevalent across the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
I may say this a little bit incorrectly only because I don't have the chart in front of me, but if you go to like the CDC website, there's like a map of America, and you can look at it over time. I think it starts maybe like in the the 1990s and the 2000s and et cetera. And as you click through the map, you can see that the country becomes like redder and redder
mm-hmm.
because of that's how they represent obesity. And at the last time, I think in 2009, perhaps, there was no state in America that had a prevalence of obesity of under 20%. So even the
yeah.
states that were more known for, like, outdoor activities, I think
mm-hmm.
Colorado and maybe
Colorado
Utah were some of those states, even those states at that point had a prevalence of obesity of 20%, which is substantial just in general for our health. But then among African-American women and among Hispanic women, that prevalence is even higher. The most recent statistic that I've seen, which I think also did come from the CDC, said that a third of African-American women were overweight or obese, and that is substantial and could have a negative impact on health in general and then specifically on reproduction.
But even when we factor in the lack of access to care, not being referred early enough, late entry into care for all the reasons we just talked about, and obesity, even when you control for all that, there is still women of color are less likely to respond successfully to IVF treatment. Is that a fair statement from your reading of the research?
Yeah, so yes. So we have seen some perhaps biological differences, and those reasons have not been fully elucidated yet. There have been some studies that show that Asian women, their estradiol levels tend to be different compared to Caucasian women, and still their success is lower. Mm-hmm. There have been a couple of studies that showed that in Asian women, and then another study looked in African American women, and that when they didn't do a fresh transfer, so when we do IVF, you know, we're giving lots of hormonal medications to stimulate the ovaries. We go and retrieve the eggs. We put the eggs and the sperm together, grow embryos, and then put the embryo back in that same into the person's uterus in that same treatment cycle. That's called a fresh transfer. Versus when you do IVF, you have the embryos, and then you freeze all of the embryos, and then you put an embryo back into the woman's uterus in at a future time. That's a frozen cycle. There have been some studies that have shown that Asian women, and one study that also looked at African American women, and it seems that they may do better in a freeze all cycle.
I found that fascinating. That I think there's more than one study that showed that. I was reading some of the posters at ASRM, and I thought I said there was one there, and it was
there may have been newer ones.
Yeah, and frozen embryo transfers were the success rates were. It looked in my memory is that they were approaching the success rates for women for white women. I could be wrong on that, but it certainly improved them. Why the heck is that? I don't get that. I'm just trying to think of a logical reason.
Well, so there is. So there's some thought that perhaps so when you're on all these hormones, your estradiol level is much higher than it is in a normal cycle. So a woman who, you know, ovulates one egg, if you check their estradiol level in the middle of their cycle, probably their estradiol level will be something like between maybe 200 and 300. Versus when you have IVF and you're having all of these eggs that are being stimulated, if these follicles that are being stimulated, you might have estradiol levels like very, very high, like 5,000 or, you know, that would be significantly higher. And the thought is that perhaps there's something in the hormonal milieu that when you do a frozen cycle and it approximates what's more normal for a typical, like a person who's actually just trying to get pregnant,
that could be a reason why that's different.
Yeah,
and I've also heard about the impact on the endometrial lining, the lining of the uterus.
Yeah, perhaps it can make a difference in the lining.
But what I don't get is why it's different because with white women, we're not seeing a increase. It was about the same last time I saw between.
Well, there are some, and this is a whole other, like, we could talk for hours on just this by itself. There are some places now that only do freeze-all cycles for all comers.
A lot of places are moving that way. No,
yeah, for all comers, Caucasian, yeah. African, anyone.
Yeah.
And so now there's some debate like, okay, well, do we really need to do that? The truth is we don't know really 100%, but it does seem that maybe in African-American women or in Asian women that this might actually make a difference. In 2017, Dr. Hill et al., and from Walter Reed / NIH, they did a series of studies that were specifically looking at prematurely elevated progesterone levels. And so there's some evidence that if the progesterone level becomes elevated too early in the process, that it can decrease pregnancy rates. They looked at some of this by race, and they found that the prevalence of an early elevated progesterone seemed to be higher among minority women. And so maybe that's something that's happening. That could be a biological reason why we might be seeing this less likelihood of pregnancy. This is still kind of like newer research, but and we haven't teased it all out. We haven't teased it all out like 100%, but it seems like there could be some biological plausibility as to why this might be happening.
Well, and it made me feel optimistic, if only because I do think that there's a strong, we're certainly seeing in the clinics that we partner with, a strong push towards moving more often to freeze all and then transfer, allow the woman's body to kind of reestablish back to normalcy and then transferring. And so we're seeing that. So I thought, well, okay, if that's the case and women of color, their success rates increase with that, then maybe we will see less in the future, less disparity of success between a black woman and a white woman. Maybe I'm trying to look for the happy ending here, but it does seem to me that that's a positive thing that we may have success with. Before we stop, I did want to, I think we'd be negligent not to talk about the impact of racism on reproductive health. One study I wanted to bring up was, I think it was a 2012 study, and it was on clinic advertising, and it found, so this is a number of years old, but still, it found that 97% of the clinics included photographs of white babies on their website. 62% featured only photographs of white babies. So if you're advertising to a white demographic, how is that going to influence the people who are coming into treatment? It may be subtle, but it's hard to argue that it wouldn't skew, that this skewed advertising is not going to have some impact on the demographic of patients that seeks you out.
That's really interesting. I had not seen that research. But you're right, representation does matter. And, you know, not seeing yourself represented among these successful outcomes could even, you know, kind of subconsciously make a person less likely to seek out care at that place. That certainly could be true. You know, there have been studies, and this is not specifically looking at reproductive health. It was more looking at a variety of other factors. And it concluded, it was a meta-analysis, a systematic review. It was done in 2015. And some of the things that were interesting were that they found an association between people who had experienced racism and their mental health, and also people who had experienced racism and the level of their physical health. And again, it wasn't specifically related to, you know, reproduction, but there was there were differences in the health of people who had those negative kinds of experiences.
And our general health influences our fertility.
Yes, general health can certainly be a predictor of, like, how likely someone is, you know, to reproduce. There are many factors associated with getting pregnant that we don't, you know, fully understand. But if you think about, you know, nutrition, lack of chronic diseases, or if you have a chronic disease, having it under control, having it well treated, it would make it more likely for a person to become pregnant if their chronic disease is under control versus not. You know, seeking out, going to a physician to seek health, to actually seek treatment, can also be, you know, impacted by that. If you've had negative experiences with physicians in the past, if you feel recently in the news, there's been a lot of talk about increased maternal mortality among African American women. And it is true across the country, black women are more likely to die in childbirth or around that time period than Caucasian women. And if you hear what some people are saying about it, is that they feel that they are not being listened to. And that plays a role. Even famous people such as Serena Williams had an experience where if she had not advocated for her health, she had I think she had a pulmonary embolism. And she kept saying to them, you know, I've had a pulmonary embolism in the past, and this is what it felt like. And finally, after, you know, she and her husband advocated for her for a diagnosis, then she was, you know, she had the appropriate diagnosis and she had the appropriate treatment. And Serena Williams is a millionaire. She's
yeah.
famous. She's well respected.
She is no shrinking violet.
She is not a shrinking violet. If she is not being listened to, then you know what must you know an everyday person you know feel like. And also Serena did have the knowledge of what was going on with her. Many women don't have any sort of like mm-hmm. Medical background or any kind of thing like that. But what women are saying over and over again, particularly women of color, is that they don't feel like they're being listened to. They feel like their mm-hmm. symptoms are being minimized. They feel like they're being called, you know, for lack of a better word, hysterical. These
mm-hmm.
sorts of things. And
hypochondria.
If that has been your perception in your healthcare history, then you might be less likely to seek out care for those reasons as well. You may be less likely to trust the care that you receive.
Yeah.
So certainly those, and you know, I also think it's important, you know, when people hear the word racism, I think lots of times people, you know, turn off. You know, particularly people who might be in the majority, they may
mm-hmm.
say, "Well, I'm not a racist, so this doesn't apply to me." And I would not say that that's not valid, but we all have implicit biases, whether they be
mm-hmm.
racial or otherwise. But when you're talking about racism, you're not talking about a person who is on purpose being racist to someone, or you know. Not treating a person appropriately because they are racist. When you're talking about racism, you're talking about, you know, unfair policies, inequality among power and resources and capacity, and then opportunities for patients.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, you know, a person level. It's like on a systemic. It can be certainly personal, but it can also be, you know, internalized. It can be interpersonal, and it can be systemic. And these are some of the barriers that we have to break down. Even those physicians who, in those that I talked about earlier, who did not refer patients, I don't think that they would have thought that they were being racist. But they definitely were exhibiting biases, and if no one pointed that out to them, they wouldn't necessarily be aware that something that they were doing was wrong.
Exactly. In fact, they would probably specifically say that they're not racist. And as you point out, maybe they
right.
aren't racist, but they've got a bias. And even if it's
right.
not a personal bias, it's the systemic. The problem with systemic racism is it's so subtle and not necessarily on its impact, but you can't pin it down. You can't pin it down
mm-hmm.
to a person. It's kind of just runs throughout. It's like a common thread that's running throughout that we have to acknowledge. In general, we have to acknowledge it, but certainly in specific to this show, acknowledge the potential impact it has on fertility issues, reproductive health. For women of color, and that's probably a great way for us to segue into letting me tell you about another one of our partners, IntegraMed Fertility. They are the largest network of fertility practices in the country. By combining the latest innovations in the reproductive sciences with compassionate and customized treatment plans, IntegraMed practices are able to provide the very best possible care. I want to mention a few resources that exists that are just really good resources for people, women of color in particular. One is, and you can just Google these to find them, and also in our show notes we will have links to, and on our website, creatingafamily.org, we will embed links to all of these. Fertility for Color Girls is a nonprofit that provides information across the board for fertility issues for particularly black women. Another one is Broken Brown Egg. I have been a follower of her for quite some time. It's a blog and actually a website now that's devoted to a lot of things, fertility, but also fertility awareness for women of color. And one I didn't know about but just found out about is Black Mamas Matter. And it is specifically talking about or trying to address the maternal mortality and maternal problems preterm labor, even if it's not mortality, issues associated with pregnancy in black women. And it's called Black Mamas Matter. And let me remind everyone that the views expressed in this show are those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family. Our sponsors are our underwriters. And also, you know, if you've got questions, this is general advice, not intended to be medical advice. So if you've got questions on how any of this applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility provider. Thank you so much, Dr. Plowden, for being with us today. This was just terrific, and I so appreciate your information and your to our audience, let me say that I'll see you next week.
Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE Appliances top load washer and dryer pair with deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and four precise water levels, just $4.78 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. Gas, dry, extra, see store for details. Valid through April 17th.
Napa Know How.
It's Love Your Car Month at Napa. And to show your car the love, get a Napa bucket for $2.99 and save 20% on almost everything you can fit inside, like car wash, car wax, and tire shine. So save some cash and look good doing it by getting 20% off with the Napa bucket. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa Know How.
Napa Know How.
At participating Napa Auto Parts stores, exclusions apply. Minimum three items may not be combined with other offers. Offer ends 4/30/19.